Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Fiscal cliff, schmiscal cliff. We went looking for people who are actually worried about it. Didn't find too many either. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 13th of November. Good to have you with us. The Congress of the United States got back to work today, lame duck, though it is. They've allotted themselves 16 working days to avoid the end of the economy as we know it. That is the end of the year when we're due to go off the aforementioned fiscal cliff. But come on, nobody really believes Congress would do that to us, would they? We sent Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff out this morning to ask around.
I set out to find someone who's actually losing sleep over the fiscal cliff. Instead, I got a lot of this from people like investment banker Chris Whalen.
The whole thing, I think, is overdone. I don't expect the Congress to go over the cliff.
How about a medium-sized business? Bob Taylor is a treasurer at Pitt, Ohio, a trucking company.
Are you scared?
No. I guess you could say people are scared of the unknown out there.
He says some of his customers are cutting back until all this is resolved. And it will be resolved, right? After all, the fiscal cliff has something to make every constituency angry. Defense cuts, tax hikes for all, you name it. But for all the focus on the year-end deadline, Gus Fauché of PNC Financial says that date doesn't really matter.
I don't think it needs to be resolved by January 1st, but it needs to look like they're making progress.
Fauché says if we were to go over the cliff, we'd plunge right into recession, and that would be a big deal. Or would it? Gregory Curtis is chairman of Wealth Advisors Graycord & Company.
I'm losing sleep because I'm afraid it's not going to happen.
Wait, he wants us to go over the cliff?
I know it sounds terrible. I don't really want it to happen. But my real fear here is that we're just going to muddle through somehow. We're going to reach some kind of a weaselly compromise that just avoids the fiscal cliff but doesn't really address the issues.
So if business isn't afraid of it, is anyone else losing sleep? Chris Whalen has one answer.
Well, I think everybody in the media, because they have to come in earlier and they're doing lots more interviews.
No comment. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
No comment is not a phrase, I believe, that has ever come out of the mouth of the subject of this next story. Donald J. Trump, by name. I apologize for having to mention him, but Trump and his business partner Macy's are the targets of a big online petition asking Macy's to stop selling Trump clothing and perfume. First of all, Trump perfume. And second of all, well, here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
Nearly 500,000 people have signed Angelo Carasone's petition.
Apparently, a lot of people also feel the same way about Macy's magic as I do.
Carasone says he's loved Macy's since he was a kid and took action when he noticed the department store was aggressively promoting brand Trump, which he doesn't think fits with brand Macy's.
The big final straw was that big $5 million stunt.
If Barack Obama opens up his college records and his passport applications and records, I will give to a charity of his choice $5 million.
Trump's products have reportedly been big sellers for Macy's, but the Donald's brand is changing, says marketing consultant Faith Popcorn.
He used to be a lot more elegant and a lot more of an icon, but what he's bringing to the brand is negative political kind of backlash.
That could hurt Trump brand sales and alienate Macy's fans, says Dan Chabelle, founder of Millennial Branding.
Donald Trump's name is his brand. If people don't like what he stands for, they're not going to buy his products.
Macy's pokes fun of Trump, asking to see Obama's birth certificate in its new holiday ad, where Trump doubts Santa's identity and insists on tugging his beard.
Let me see for myself.
Oh, go ahead. Pull it.
Neither Trump nor Macy's answered requests for comments, but the Donald tweeted today that his cologne, Success by Trump, was the perfect Christmas gift. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Oh, man. Wasn't happening today at the corner of Wall Street and Broad in Lower Manhattan. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. 2 weeks and a day after Sandy hit the East Coast, life for most is starting to get back to normal. Most, but by no means all. For people whose homes were flooded or destroyed in places like the Rockaways or out on the Jersey Shore, life won't be the same for quite some time to come. That's true for New Yorkers who live far above the high water mark as well. Tracy Samuelson checked in with Manhattanites still waiting to go home.
Beth Rice lives in a one-bedroom apartment in a luxury high-rise with floor-to-ceiling windows and river views. For $3,000 a month, she gets a kitchen she loves to cook in and enough space that she can read in one room while her husband's on the computer in another. But we are not in that place.
Oh, so this is it.
Wow.
Yeah. It's interesting, right?
This is small. Yeah.
For much of the first week and a half after the storm, Beth and her husband hold up in a Midtown hotel that's maybe 90 square feet. For $160 a night, they got a bed that's about 2 feet from the bathroom, separated only by a frosted glass door.
It's not, let's say, soundproof.
When Hurricane Sandy sent salt water flooding through the basement of Rice's building in New York's financial district, it fried the mechanical systems and sent a strong gas odor throughout the building. Rice and her neighbors have been told it'll be at least 2 months before they can move back home. But even though she lives on the 11th floor and her apartment is completely dry, her renter's insurance likely won't cover her expenses.
As a renter, I would have never even thought that I needed flood insurance.
Rice recently moved to a different hotel that FEMA's paying for, and she's looking for longer-term housing. But according to Con Ed, there are roughly 65 office and residential buildings in Lower Manhattan in a similar situation. Rice knows that she and her neighbors are better off than many other people in the storm's path. Some will never be able to go home again. But for her, it's just not knowing when that's hard.
Some buildings were incredibly communicative, checking in with folks, you know, literally two or three times a day.
Lockhart Steele is the founder of a real estate blog called Curbed.
Other folks would go days without hearing from their building. And obviously, the folks who went days without hearing from their building got pretty angry, and a lot of them still are pretty angry.
Steele's site has been crowdsourcing information from tenants in roughly 24 affected buildings, including his own. He and his girlfriend are crashing on friends' couches while they figure out what to do next.
We've been planning day by day. We've just started moving up to week by week. And we have our eyes set on month to month.
Heather Hansen is in a similar holding pattern. She lives in the financial district with her boyfriend and two other roommates. But for much of the first 2 weeks after the storm, she commuted into the city from her parents in central New Jersey, 2 hours each way.
Welcome to New Jersey Transit.
I took things for granted. Going home and only having a 30-minute commute and having that spare time.
Now she's competing against everyone else who's been displaced by the storm and is looking for housing.
I'm looking at things online. I mean, none of the sublets are going to be like home. You know, we might find a studio. We might have to still get roommates, which is not really optimal.
Some buildings said tenants won't have to pay rent for the time they can't live there. And some renters can just get out of their leases if they want to find a new place altogether. But moving out of a high-rise with no electricity isn't exactly easy. Without the elevator, tenants' furniture and all their belongings are stuck up in their sky-high apartments. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
A story now about a guy who invented a technology to keep you out of trouble, but who now finds himself up to his ears in it, quite possibly. Such is the case of John McAfee. You'll recognize the name if you've ever paid any attention to the antivirus software on your computer. McAfee is now being sought for questioning in the connection of a murder of a fellow American expat in Belize, where he's been living just off the coast since 2008. Jeff Wise has been writing about this very strange story for the tech site Gizmodo. And Jeff, to be clear, this is the John McAfee of McAfee Antivirus, right?
That's right. He's the man. He's on a lot of people's computers.
And he is now in Belize, wanted for murder.
Well, technically, I think they say they're interested in finding out where he is. But I think that's pretty much why they're interested
What happened? I mean, you've known this guy for a number of years. You've talked to him about a bunch of other things that he's done in his life. How did he get to this point? How did it get to this point?
It's been a strange sort of narrative arc. When I first got to know him, he was living the life down in New Mexico. He had bought this big ranch with an airstrip, and he had invented this new sport that he wanted America to embrace. It was called aerotracking, and the idea was that you would fly these little tiny airplanes really low over the desert, like 10 feet off the ground. And it sounds kind of dangerous, and it really is kind of dangerous. And it was very exciting and kind of fun, and I went there to write a profile of this really larger-than-life character, and I really was quite fond of him and thought he was a neat guy and sort of a model of how to lead an exciting, engaged life. But as the years went by, you know, his story became a little bit more nuanced, a little more complicated. I wrote an article about him in 2010 in Fast Company that was a little bit more critical, and then in the wake of that, people started coming forward and telling me about a darker side of John McAfee.
Let's remind people how he got his start. Back in the 90s, he came up with his antivirus software and then went on television and went on the media and said, there are millions and millions of computers in this country that are at risk of this virus unless you download my software, I guess.
Right. So he created this organization called the Antivirus Software Association or something. And he went on national TV and he said the Michelangelo virus is going to devastate American computers. It was like an early version of Y2K. Hmm. And like Y2K, that all-important date came and went and nothing happened. And some people were outraged. And some people said, well, good thing we had this McAfee antivirus to protect us. But in the wake of that, his name was somewhat tainted. And so he wound up cashing out of the company. There's no real grounds for this number, but people throw around the number of $100 million. Yeah. One of the things you have to understand when you talk about anything about John McAfee is that if he's the only source for something, you have to take it with a grain of salt.
And now we have these headlines, and you're reporting in the past couple of days, saying the Belizean police are looking for him on a murder charge.
Exactly. So McAfee had started to act in an increasingly eccentric manner. And he most recently started walking around town with a gun, a holstered gun, which is not legal, apparently, in Belize.
Yeah.
And this really sketched people out. He has nine, I guess, fairly vicious dogs that bark and lunge at people.
Nine, just because, you know, three aren't enough.
This is nine after one had already been shot by a combined team of special forces and SWAT team members who raided his compound in the jungle a few months before.
Wow.
So he's been getting into a hairy situation. I mean, the other thing is that he's proudly talks about how he employs a number of Belize's most hardened drug criminals.
Wow. This is all, it's weird, obviously, but it's a little sad, too, right?
Yeah, it is a little sad. I mean, here's a guy who had everything. He walked away from this company he founded with millions and millions of dollars. He was, in the prime of life. He could do whatever he wanted to do. And the tragedy is a certain person put in that situation, it will ruin them.
Mm. Jeff Wise and the very strange tale of John McAfee. He's been writing about it for Gizmodo. He writes for Popular Mechanics as well. Jeff, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thanks very much, Kai.
A quick postscript on this story before we move on. John McAfee got a hold of Wired.com today, said he's innocent of the murder that the Belizean police want to talk to him about. Coming up, sometimes Google just ain't all that great, you know.
Personally, I can't see that it has done anything for our town.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials clawed their way into positive territory for much of the day and then surrendered to those nagging worries about Europe and the fiscal cliff here at home. Stocks sank back into the red in the final hour of trading. The blue chip index down 58 points, almost a half percent, 12,756 the number. The NASDAQ off 20 points, not quite 0.75%, 2883 the final number there. The S&P 500 carved off 5 points, 0.4%, 1374 at the close. The market's short-lived midday rally was built largely on Home Depot's strong quarterly results. Stock in the home improvement retailer rose 3.5% today to its highest value in more than a decade. Bond prices rose. That nudged the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.59%. And you're listening to MarketPlace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday.
We'll see how well retail sales did in the month of October. That data comes from the Commerce Department. PetSmart and Williams-Sonoma will release their earnings. That's food for your pet and food for you. And on this day, 90 years ago, the BBC hit the airwaves for the first time. They reported on, among other things, the latest billiard scores. Oh, how far we've come. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know the stories you read about all the gridlock in Manhattan whenever President Obama, or any president for that matter, pays a visit? Or the moaning about half the highways here in L.A. being shut down whenever he comes out here for a fundraiser? Same thing's been happening in Beijing this week during the Communist Party Congress. The capital is China's number one tourist destination, except for this week. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
Huang Yanhe pedals his pedicab around the rear entrance to Beijing's Forbidden City, trying to make eye contact with foreigners, groups wearing identical long-billed caps, folks who look hopelessly lost, anyone who appears to be a tourist. But it's tough this week.
I can't find anyone. We're way too obsessed with the 18th Party Congress.
Huang wears a badge with the name of his company, Three Oceans Flaming Dragon Culture Consulting Company. Culture consulting in Beijing is at an all-time low, says Huang, thanks to all the security surrounding the leadership transition.
All the tour groups are gone, and it's a hassle going anywhere because of traffic restrictions. Many tourist sites are off-limits, so most people have canceled their trips. We're all just waiting for the Party Congress to finish so we can get back to work.
It seems tourist Ma Hongqian didn't get the memo. She's enjoying a quiet walk around Hohai Lake, sans the usual loud tour groups. She skipped Tiananmen Square. Visitors have to go through two sets of pat-downs and ID checks before they're allowed there. She stayed away from the Forbidden City, too. This week, it's living up to its name.
Some of the tour sites are simply closed. On the bright side, it was really easy for me to buy a train ticket here.
Ma's from Xi'an, 730 miles away. All this has her thinking about China's leaders inside the Great Hall of the People and what she's hoping they accomplish.
They need to do something about the property market. I used to work for a cement company, and our sales plummeted after the government enacted property controls in the market.
But then Ma pauses, mid-sentence, and changes her mind.
I guess those measures were actually good, because a lot of people like me, we can't afford to buy a home. I couldn't even afford a down payment. Will this bubble get worse? All of this deserves some serious consideration.
Ma will have a couple more days in quiet Beijing to think about the country's problems before the city, the rest of the country, and China's leaders can get back to work. In Beijing, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
I'm going to say something now. You're not going to believe it, but I'm going to say it anyway, and then Sarah Gardner is going to tell us about it. Sylvania has a new light bulb coming to market. $50, $50, for an LED bulb that gives as much light as an old-fashioned 100-watt incandescent. The government is gradually phasing out less energy-efficient lighting, like incandescents, but still, $50 for a bulb? From the Sustainability Desk, here's Sarah.
The government started dimming the lights on incandescents earlier this year, starting with 100-watt bulbs. The phase-out ends in 2014 with the 40-watt. The response from manufacturers? Innovation. Sylvania's new LED is slightly longer than a traditional light bulb, but it looks like a light bulb. None of that swirly CFL tubing. Still, it's $50.
What do you get for $50? You get the chance to have that light bulb for years and years, not have to change it. You can put it in when your child is born and take it out when your child goes to college.
Marianne Damasio at the Appliance Standards Awareness Project says you also don't get the mercury that comes with CFLs, and LEDs won't wear out as quickly from being switched on and off, like the CFLs in my bathroom. And Jeff Harris at the Alliance to Save Energy says companies will still make incandescents. They just have to meet the government's new efficiency standards, sort of like gas-powered cars having to meet higher mileage ratings.
What they've banned is the traditional and inefficient incandescent light bulb. The ones that are being sold today to replace them are 25 to 30% more efficient and last about the same amount of time.
Harris points out you can still find the old 100-watt bulbs as companies sell off their remaining stock. We saw some on 1000bulbs.com today, going for 49 cents each. Antique collectors get them while they last. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
All right, so stop with whatever Google search you're doing right now and ponder this for just a second. That lightning-fast list of results that starts showing up even before you hit enter doesn't just happen, you know. It takes a tremendous amount of back-end computing power, which comes courtesy of rows and rows and rows of servers that are housed in what are called data centers all over the country. One of those centers opened in Caldwell County, North Carolina, 4 years ago. And at the time, Google was a welcome addition to a region clobbered by the decline of its furniture and textile industries. Whether it's worked out like everybody thought, that's another question. Marketplace's David Gura has the story from Lenore, North Carolina.
In small towns, people gossip. They talk to their neighbors, they talk about their neighbors, and that includes corporate neighbors. Just 5 minutes south of downtown Lenore, in the center of Caldwell County, there are two giant buildings flanked by tall cooling towers rising above rolling fields. It's a Google facility, and it's shrouded in secrecy. Deborah Murray runs the local Economic Development Commission, and she says it's been that way since the beginning.
There had been this great mystery, and everybody had an opinion as to what it was going to be and what it was going to do.
Officially, it's a data center, but some residents have their own theories, some a bit far-fetched, like Google's running experiments on space aliens or on a Sasquatch. But there are some other mysteries more grounded in reality.
Google doesn't tell us how many people they have hired. We continue to ask. That's one of their secrets.
And it's one that really bothers many Lenore residents like Yvonne Miller, who works at a bookstore off Main Street.
Personally, I can't see that it has done anything for our town.
So you haven't heard of people getting jobs there? Or...
No, I've heard just the opposite.
But is that really true?
Turn right onto Morganton Boulevard Southwest.
I decided to see for myself. Google's data center is up the road from an old furniture factory, and security is pretty tight.
Got two forms everybody has to fill out before they come on site. One is Google's non-disclosure agreement. Even the man coming to pick up the garbage has to sign in. He don't even go in the buildings.
The other form includes more rules. I give the guard my driver's license, and 10 minutes later, I go through the gate and meet Enoch Muller, the operations manager.
All right, well, you just missed lunch by a few minutes, but there might still be some baklava for you.
Google's headquarters is far away, but there's still plenty of what makes Google, Google. There's a giant cafeteria brimming with free food, just like in Silicon Valley. And there's ping pong and foosball. But the decor here is very North Carolina. NASCAR memorabilia is everywhere.
There's a place near Charlotte where we went and got a whole bunch of body parts from cars, from actual races, and we used those to decorate the facility.
At least the parts I'm allowed to see. This is a pretty short tour.
If you want some audio, I can't take you out here, but you may be able to catch enough.
Okay.
We stop at a big, thick door, and I can hear something. But like most of Lenore's residents, I can only wonder what happens on the other side.
I can't say specifically what's out there, but there's a lot of machines.
Processing searches, Muller tells me, YouTube videos, Google Maps. Since my visit, Google has posted pictures of the facility online. Muller says Google came here to this remote county for a few reasons.
Power, cooling, land, those are the primary factors we were looking for.
Furniture factories also require a lot of electricity and running water, so the infrastructure in this part of North Carolina is ready-made for data centers. But there's another big reason why Google picked Lenore. TJ Rohr is on the city council.
I knew Google was going to get incentives. Any big manufacturer that comes to town is going to get incentives.
Rohr voted against them. He's a libertarian. Those incentives were very generous.
100% of personal property exemption for the next 30 years and 80% of real property for exemption for the next 30 years.
The incentive package is reportedly worth $260 million. Google's Enoch Muller says he's heard the criticism that those incentives haven't resulted in enough jobs for people in Caldwell County. But he says the first place he goes to for resumes is the local community college. Muller did tell me how many people work at Google's facility here, about 115 of them. But he knows that number would disappoint many people.
If you think of traditional manufacturing, a building of this size could potentially employ 400 or 500 people in the same footprint. A data center, the density of individuals required to maintain a facility is just not that high.
Lenore did get something else. Having a multinational tech company in your backyard does carry some cachet. But it didn't replace the furniture industry, or it hasn't yet. Still, it may have started something, a data center corridor in western North Carolina. Google and Lenore have some new corporate neighbors. Facebook and Apple are just up the road. In Lenore, North Carolina, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, a nod to those who say the economy is going to the dogs, and I mean that in the most literal sense of the word. We bring you now, courtesy of the market research firm Euromonitor International, the Dog Index. It tracks, I kid you not, the percentage change in the number of dogs in a given country in the past 5 years and makes an admittedly loose correlation between that and the rate of economic development. Makes sense, in a way, disposable income to spend on pets and all that. Anyway, India is number one, dogs up 58% the past 5 years. Switzerland is last, down about 10% there. There is way, way more data on our website, should you be curious, marketplace.org. And with that, we're out of here. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 58 points, nearly a half percent. The NASDAQ down 20 points, almost 0.75%. The S&P 500 gave back 5 points, 0.4%. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Mary Dew, Justin Ho, and Katie Long on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.